The following 41-minute recording is from the 2007 EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative Annual Meeting in a session entitled The Millennium Student and Now Evidence for the Millennial Instructor. For more information about EDUCAUSE, visit our website. It's www.educause.edu.
I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's featured session. As noted, today's session, the Millennium Student and Now Evidence for the Millennial Instructor. And it's my pleasure to introduce Carl Berger, and I'm going to read some information from his EDUCAUSE bio because it's marvelous. Many of you know Carl, and for those of you that don't, it's just worth hearing. So Carl is retired, semi-retired, trying to be retired, but will refuse to retire. Professor and Dean Emeritus at the University of Michigan and Director of the Advanced Academic Technologies in the Collaboratory for Advanced Research and Academic Technologies, also known as CARET. In the Provost Office, he's a National Research Fellow for the Apple Digital Campus Program with Apple Computers. And in 2006, he was honored being named as the New Media Consortium Fellow, the second such fellow in the 14-year history of the award. Carl is probably best known for working to understand how people learn technology and assessment of the appropriate use of technology in teaching and learning. He was also founder of EDUCAUSE's National Learning Infrastructure, NLII's Academic Educational Support Objects Program, also known as ASOP, in 1995. He's the author of 21 books and over 60 chapters and articles, and holds 2 patents. Carl was recognized in the EDUCAUSE meeting in 1999 for his leadership and involvement in NLII and his work on the IMS project. And in 96, he received the Distinguished Contributions to Science Education Award from the National Association for Research in Science Teaching. We know that Carl will not ever retire because he has so much to contribute to this community, and we really welcome Carl being here today.
That was nice. You, however, forgot about my 5 grandkids. That's the other thing. And for any of you who wish to know this, this is an early bird special. I always like to give people who come early a little early bird special, and that is, if you ever have the opportunity, retire first and then work. Believe me, retirement is everything it's cracked up to be. It really is great. Well, I wanted to talk to you today and work with you about the Millennial Instructor. I know that some of you are here because you heard about the program. Others are here because you didn't hear about the program but decided to stay anyway because you sat down and it's not worth getting up again. So I appreciate whoever is here. I saw you, Reed, get up. I saw that in the back. Yeah, sure. In any event, I really appreciate you coming up here because this is a fascinating story, and I'm going to repeat it tomorrow. So for those of you who don't get it today, you can come tomorrow and see if I got it, because I'll probably do a better job tomorrow, but I'm going to do it for those people. So if somebody says, I thought Carl was presenting tomorrow, I will present tomorrow morning as well. It's at 8 o'clock. Yes, you had those classes, and you probably also taught those classes too, so you can imagine I'm not worried about it. But the Millennial Instructor is interesting. It's an interesting tale because of the way it came about. It's something we've kind of expected. We've heard all about the Millennial Student. We get a feeling that we understand the Millennial Student, or we're getting there. It's really tough to get there. But what's happening is there out there something different, a different kind of person out there who might be, for example, the Millennial Instructor, something we might have expected all along. Well, we kind of stumbled into it, and I'd like to share that with you. As you may know, we give a lot of surveys at Michigan. We give a survey every year and have done so since 1986. How many years is that, my friends? Yes? It's 11, isn't it? Right. Yeah, you got it. Absolutely. You folks know your mathematics. Anyway, we've done surveys for that long. We got going very heavily into it in the late 90s and the early aughts by literally starting to do a survey every other year of our students, and in between that every other year, our faculty. We had wonderful response rates, really surprised us. One of the reasons why we got some pretty darn good response rates was we always went back to both the students and faculty and said, here's what you said on the survey, and here's how we're changing our university infrastructure to meet what you've said. And boy, that raises the level of response from year to year. It's great. So, you know, we're taking a look at data here on, we've got samples of roughly 2,000 students and 600 faculty. It's not too shabby data. Now, there's a lot of good surveys out there, really great surveys. And when taken as a whole, they paint a really nice picture. So what you're going to hear me talk about today is not necessarily completely unusual, though I hope there'll be a little unusual twist on it, because great surveys have been done not only at Michigan, but at Wisconsin, at Minnesota, at Texas, and also in Washington. So there's great surveys out there today. We just had a session before this session on a tremendous, great survey they had done at Seton Hall. That's how I know people are here from Seton Hall. Did you see that? Pretty clever. Okay, anyway, thank you. That was a good session, by the way. I really enjoyed that. In any event, remember, some of these findings may not pertain to you that you'll find today, but I'll bet you'll go out, and if you do the same kinds of things we've done or the kinds of things they've done at Seton Hall, you'll find that you'll get very fascinating results as well. Many surveys have surveyed the millennial student, but still many have also documented what faculty do and how faculty work with it. Faculty are willing to learn on their own. Faculty like books, manuals, and anything with a cost, particularly if it comes back into their pocket. That's why they write their own textbooks. But they often love to build their own learning environments. It's tough for senior faculty, unlike what you often see in the K-12 system, where they'll adopt a curriculum and the teacher will generally follow relatively closely the text and the materials with that curriculum. Faculty at colleges and universities don't do that. They love to build their own. So you'll see some different kinds of things coming out of it. And this is well documented in the surveys that are out there today. But it's still doggone perplexing in some respects because there's a significant group of faculty that do not seem to conform to what are called adult learning principles. For example, for many of them, convenience is a lot stronger than the need to know. It really is. They would rather have something conveniently done than to have to go out and find it. That's one of the characteristics we found, that a colleague is oftentimes more important than expertise. If they see a colleague doing it, they will do it. Even though we know that we've got expertise in the organization, they feel far more comfortable with their colleagues. And in my office is far more important than the hotline. Do any of you run a hotline? Raise your hands if you run a hotline. Good, good. Glad to see there's still a few out there. How many of you actually go into the faculty members' offices and actually work with them? My sympathies are with you and my congratulations as well. You betcha. And as you can see by the number of hands, they do actually do prefer that. You can do a little test here. So the curse of the successful traditional teaching, I think, is part of the problem we've got. So many faculty look at the students who have gone in their classes and become tremendously successful and say, well, look, what I've done, my traditional lecture techniques and all, I've done really well. I'm not so sure I need to change. But I think I have to change personally. This is Carl Berger, because just 2 days ago, one of my former students did not do well. I was very, very disappointed in Tom Brady. The time, efforts, and relevance to teaching are critical. You can talk all you want about how wonderful it is, how much the students will get it, but the faculty will come back and say, look, how much time does it take? How much effort is it? How truly relevant is it to teaching? They'll decide that. And, of course, the three dreaded ones. How much recognition do I get? How much reward do I get? And the bullet. Does this count toward tenure? You bet. So those are the tough ones. And awareness of not reaching the student may be the tipping point. In other words, I think what we're starting to see now with faculty is they're beginning to see that they're right almost at the tipping point where they're saying, but wait a minute, we are not meeting the needs of the millennial student. We've got to do something about it. And you'll begin to see faculty doing this. So that may be relevant. Then again, it may be totally irrelevant. Is it all faculty that see this? Well, we're not so sure, because we think that there's a variety of learning styles. There's a variety of teaching styles for faculty just as well. There's a culture of local department or field of study. The kinds of things that happen in a local department can be quite exciting. Our chemistry department at the University of Michigan is one of the strongest and most forward-looking in the kinds of work that they do with students, surprisingly so. When just a few years ago, our chemistry department was the one where the faculty members stood at the beginning class and said, I want you to each look to the person next to you. At the middle of this term, one of you will not be here. And it will probably be you. And that was the Weider course in our university. You know what Weider courses are. Yeah, you betcha. Well, the chemistry department is no longer the Weider course in our university. So there's a variety of faculty types and something new. Could there be a new group of emerging? And we think there could, and that might be the millennial instruction. So here's how we found it. A funny thing happened on the way to giving our surveys. As I mentioned, we used to give our surveys once a year to faculty, once a year to students. In 2005, we decided to put the two surveys together, give a single survey to both faculty and students. It was tough. As the folks at Seton Hall had found, we had a whole series of wonderful, wonderful questions, and we started melding them together and asking, are these the right questions to ask? And can we ask them such that both faculty and students can answer the same type of question? Turned out we could do a pretty good job with that. But we had some problems with it. For example, we asked them at one point to tell us their role in the university and their affiliation. And of course, we thought that would evenly divide it up between students and faculty. Well, it did, except we ended up with more responses than we had surveys. Now, how can you get more responses than you have surveys? Well, it's because some of the students that identified themselves as students also identified themselves as having a faculty role. And guess what? Some of the faculty that identified themselves as faculty, and we could trace to make sure that they were faculty, also identified themselves as having formal learning roles in the university. Now, this is not only, although there might be some of them, that type of faculty member that you hire that's finishing up their dissertation or something like that. Is there anyone here that falls into that trap? Okay, good. I'm glad to see that you all passed that. In any event, we have some of those, and so we had an interesting group, so that made for some unusual comparisons. And we thought, wouldn't it be cool to take a look at this group of people and see how they do compare and what they might come out to be? So we took a look at the students, the faculty, and this new group, a chance to directly compare by looking at responses to the same themes and comparing, in fact, responses within those themes to the same questions. On our surveys, we always try to lump our questions together to get at particular themes. Seems to work out well because it doesn't allow one question to have to stand on its own and do it. So we're drawing some conclusions. So today you're going to hear some conclusions that we're drawing which may not be correct. Therefore, we're asking for your indulgence and participation to see if we cannot find out whether this is really true or not, or whether we do at Michigan have a fluke and this stuff just comes out. So here's our 2006 survey. We looked to make sure the results were similar to the one we did in 2005, where we did it the very first time and found out this unusual group of people and thought, well, we better check again in 2006 because this just really may be something that happened in 2005. And indeed, we found out to make sure the results were similar to 2005. They're not identical, but very much the same. And a few more fell into this hybrid group. That kind of intrigued us. A few more fell into this hybrid group that we have. So how we discovered it was a section on demographics. Here's the association. Are you full, part-time, visiting, postdoc, adjunct, student, faculty, researcher, or librarian? And over on the other side, here's your role in the university. Kind of interesting. So you could actually put those together and get quite a combination in which we divided and found out that we, in fact, had an unusual combination. So we had students who taught, faculty involved in formal learning. Focus seemed to be on teaching and learning. And we wanted to know, would this group look different? Probably, we thought, probably an older group than the students. Maybe the part of the students would be the older group, you know, that's coming into graduation. They're the millennial students. They're graduating and starting to tip over into faculty, and maybe we'll see a group that way. So we predicted that. Probably a young faculty group. You know, the young faculty coming in from different places, and they're probably far more millennial than anybody else, so we kind of predicted that. And we also predicted that they would probably be just like the faculty, maybe an echo of the faculty. So if we had a profile of the faculty, as you'll see, they would follow that profile of the faculty. Or maybe they would just echo the students. Maybe the student profile would be this way, and they would lean more over to a different end of it or something like that. So we were taking a look at that. How many? 1,731 students, 391 faculty, 321 students claiming faculty roles, and 83 faculty claiming student roles, and there you are. And you can take a look, that nice little slice in there, 16% of them, we started then to call, just for sake of lumping it together, perhaps our Millennium faculty. And that little pie chart gives the idea of 69% students and 15% faculty. 3% faculty plus and 13% student plus giving us a total of 16% overall. So what distinguishes this millennium instructor? Well, I'm going to give you a few things that we found, and you can take a look at and see what you think. Age, expertise, user need of support and patience, or how about win-winnie? You all know what win-winnie is? Remember WYSIWYG? What I need when I need it. Win-winnie. Maybe those faculty members are more win-winnie than the millennial faculty members. Maybe that, more of that or less of that. We'll see. We'll take a look. So we tried to look at some of these characteristics. Well, here's our age pattern. Take a look at this. Kind of interesting. Here's our faculty. For those of you who are into the stats, you probably recognize this as a box and whisker plot. And this is pretty true for, particularly for Chuck Zubian and I, who have whiskers. Box and whiskers plot make good sense. Never mind. That's a statistics joke. And you have to be, nobody ever laughs. Okay. What it really means is you've got right in the middle about 50% of the population in the box there. And the little numbers up on top and the numbers down on the bottom go up higher or not, and the little dots represent the outliers. So as you can see, our student is much younger. Our millennial instructors, or MIs, are a little older. And our faculty are much older. Notice it goes up to about 76, 77, 78 years old. You may not like that, but I represent that remark. Okay? It's kind of nice. Notice also that our faculty, who are full faculty and have full faculty roles, go down to as low as 20. Can you imagine that? We've got full faculty, not necessarily full professors, but full faculty who are down around 20. But look at our millennial folk. They look like they go down to around 18 and all the way up to where they're over 50 years old. So it isn't just a slightly older only student population. It is a slightly older student population, but not only. And of course, it does nevertheless, when you take a look at our student population, it reflects a pretty broad range there as well, with that one student hanging out there who looks like they're about 68 years old. Yeah, sooner or later they're going to graduate. Sooner or later. Okay. So that's kind of neat. In between 17 to 52, 50% from 24 to 29, 90% from 20 to 34. So we do not believe that millennial instructors are limited by youth only. We think that it might, in fact, be something different. Scott and I were discussing this briefly, that we were taking a look and thought that we might see this wave coming in. There probably have been faculty all along that we've had out there that are millennial faculty, and you and I have recognized those people. They have just never been categorized this way. Okay, so let's take a look at how about their expertise. This was a fun one. Now, I've got the expertise from novice to expert. Obviously, novice is going to be more on the warning side of the curve, and expert's going to be more on the green go side of the curve for us, but it's a nice way to do it, and we ask not, are you the typical novice, intermediate, expert? And by the way, we define all these things with good paragraphs, so it isn't necessarily an unlocalized type of thing. But we took a look at the range between novice and expert, and we asked it not just, are you a novice and expert, which is normally done on surveys. We asked them to rate it in three categories. Are they a novice or an expert in their use of technology in education, in their use in technology in research, and their personal use of technology? Sound interesting? Sounds a little familiar, doesn't it, Seton Hall? You darn betcha it does. Kind of cool. So, it was kind of neat. Let's take a look at it. Bingo. Student is the little box right here, and the faculty is the little black circle, and there is this group out here, out there. Now, if you'll notice, they too have whiskers on them, out at the edges. Anybody know what those are? Error bars, or otherwise known as confidence intervals. And if confidence intervals overlap, as many of you remember from your stats, you didn't think you'd get away from it, did you? A little class in stats, you betcha, hang on close. I see you're already grimacing. It's terrible. You remember that if the confidence intervals overlap, you really can't make a claim that the two populations are different, because there is a chance that if you redid the same experiment 95% of the time with roughly the same population, that 5% of the time, they would probably be identical. So you have to watch out for those things. But if they don't overlap, you can say with some reasonable sense that, by gosh, they really are different. So, cool. As far as education is concerned, they are different. They look different. They respond differently in terms of their own perception of their expertise. And notice, who is the greatest novice? Faculty. Who, however, is the greatest up there, the most expert? Why, it happens to be that group that we labeled, and they are quite different. They're not in between. They're way over, which, by the way, you might expect when you think about it. But wait, there's more. Today, no. Take a look at research. Isn't that cool? Now, here, as you can see, all of a sudden, the faculty shoot forward. Why is that? You betcha. The faculty, it's important to them because it is their reward structure. It is their life at the University of Michigan. That's often what they were hired for. So all of a sudden, you see the whole notion of faculty and research just bounces forward. The students, by the way, as you might expect, have quite a bit less confidence, or if you would, perception of their expertise in research. And that's because in spite of all we talk about and in spite of all the undergraduate research experience that many of our institutions have, I see a smiling face back there, they're not there yet, obviously. But once again, take a look at that doggone group of others out there that still hang on pretty good. Well, what about personal life? Let's take a look at the personal life and see what we get. Well, once again, the students go up again, similar to what many of us have found, that students often use technology and see their ability to use technology as being greater, their confidence, if you will, their perception of their expertise much greater in their personal life. In fact, if you look at the error bars, you can see that it really does a pretty nice job there of differentiating them just by looking up and down the same group of people. The faculty come back down. They don't have as much use of technology in their personal life. But again, once again, there's this group out there. By the way, I want you to think about the questions that you ask, just as you did, because what I'd like to do when we get done with this, if this is at all an interesting topic, wouldn't it be cool, that's a student technological phrase, wouldn't it be cool to come up with a survey that would be designed to ask such questions that might really tease out the differences in faculty groups? Now, why would we ever do that? Because as you know, we got to deal with them on a daily basis, and wouldn't it be very nice if we knew how to do that? So I thought that just that simple question that we ask on expertise is kind of fun. Now, we'd have never got that if we just said, by the way, what is your expertise with technology that you see on a lot of surveys? So we're kind of hoping that many people will see the surveys that many of us are doing where we're asking for expertise in various areas as a way of getting at some underlying ideas there that we think are pretty important. Okay, it's not in between. More expertise on all categories, significantly differ on education and personal. They are like the faculty in research. Like the faculty, kind of neat. Millennial instructors have a strong perception of expertise. That's one of the bottom lines we came up with. Of all of our groups, they're looking pretty darn good. Oh, now this is a cool one. I really like this one. It's a little tough to read. I'm sorry that all of you did not move up to the front of the room like you were encouraged to do, particularly those of you who are of such age as I that probably can't even see the damn screen from where you're sitting. Okay. Thank you, Reed. I know why you moved up here. In any event, this one was, how do you like to learn about technology for teaching and learning? From the least to the most. Notice we start over here. Can you all see this little red light here? Okay, that's called a laser. All right. Well, you get a science lesson to boot. Okay, so there you are. The most over here is self-taught from exploring and or experimenting. Notice the groups are right over here. These two groups, the faculty and students, you can't tell the difference. But the millennial folk are even farther, significantly farther over in terms of, boy, that's the way they like to learn about using technology. The next one is help from friends, family, and colleagues. The faculty are significantly different, but here the students and the millennials go together. Down here, self-taught from books, journals, and websites. In this case, it is the students that are down here and the faculty and millennials together there. On-the-job training, by the way, notice things are going down. From IT support staff, the thing that drags it over this way more often than not is our faculty do, in fact, like to learn using our IT support staff. Congratulations, gang. However, before you get feeling that everything is good, notice your students do not like to learn from IT support staff. They probably don't even know what one would look like. But the millennials are right in between the two there. Computer seminars, it's going way down, way down. From U of M telephone consultants, way down. Our faculty still push it up a little bit. And then, of course, the least thing they want to learn on is online computer classes. Can you guess which major Midwestern university spent about $500,000 installing an online class to teach faculty and students how to do basic skills in computing? Okay, you all have that one firmly in mind. Can you imagine which Midwestern university gave the license for the use of that software to the state of Michigan? That narrows it down a little bit, doesn't it? So that all the citizens of Michigan would not learn that way. Believe me, it belongs to the state of Michigan, and indeed, it is not doing well. So online computer classes are not all that great. Friends, family, teaching and learning, great, but some nice characteristics. Self-taught, like students. There you are. There's the places where they're like students. Like faculty in those places, which are self-taught from books, journals, on-the-job training, and in computer seminars. And IT support, there they are there. And they don't like telephone, and they certainly do not like computer classes. So we're starting to get perhaps a start of a profile for these. Okay, let me see if I've got this right. Barriers in using technology for teaching and learning. Barriers in using technology for teaching and learning. I believe this question is probably the most telling question of any that you can ask. Though we try to reduce the number of what we call matrix questions. Do you know what a matrix question is? I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I am going to ask for a nod of heads. So how many of you know what a matrix question is? Matrix question is one that asks, for example, do you believe a high barrier, a low barrier, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, of instructors don't know how to implement it? And right underneath that is another sub-question that looks like it's still the same question, by the way, that says, do you believe that there's a barrier for extra work with little connection to the course? So they would click that's a high barrier or low barrier. So what you have is a question that looks like a big box with the lines of the sub-questions in it, all dealing with barriers, and the student or faculty member or millennial just goes down that thing and clicks according to how they feel about that, and that's the kind of profile that it devises from that. Does that help to understand what a matrix question is? But look at this. It is really cool. This, by the way, is just students and faculty. You wait till you see what happens when we get our millennials in there. But here we are with students and faculty. The students right there believe that the highest barrier to the utilization or to using technology for teaching and learning happens to be the fact that the instructors don't know how to implement it. That's the students' feeling about that. Isn't that interesting? However, take a look right next to them, though significantly different, if you will, right there. That's the faculty. Even the faculty, though that's not the largest one, that's not the greatest barrier, right there, the faculty believe it is the instructors that don't know how to implement it. By the way, the faculty also believe it takes extra work and has little connection with the course, but their greatest barrier is, just as we thought before, they see it as taking too much time. That's a too much time one. Notice down here, this is a very fascinating one. Here's the faculty on the barrier called Students Don't Know How to Use It. Notice the faculty are claiming that the students don't know how to use it is a low barrier. The students themselves see it as a higher barrier for themselves. Isn't that fascinating? Now, what is so fascinating about that? That means that if the faculty really believe the students aren't a barrier, the students really do a good job, and the students themselves say, wait a minute, we're not so sure we're not a barrier. If you sit down and do the focus groups, as many of us believe you've really got to go in to find out what these things are all about, you'll hear students say something like, well, sure, I multitask. Sure, I do all this stuff, but you know something? I'm a mile wide and 1 inch deep. In other words, they do a lot of tasks, but they do not have a lot of depth in those tasks. And one of the things they often want is to have, can we help, can we, professors, people, help to give them that depth? So that shows up in there. Too complicated, far more for the professors than the students. Don't have technical support, far more for the faculty than the students. That's almost in the green area. I don't have the skills, faculty here, and students clear over here. The students actually believe that they do have the skills. The faculty do not believe that they have the skills. They still see that as a barrier to doing that. Isn't that a revealing graph? And you know, for those of you who enjoy those darn whiskers that go out there, those confidence intervals, they really tell you whether it's significant or not. Really cool. Really cool. Now, for those of you who know your stats, you can scratch your head and say, well, I'm not sure having a scale of high barrier to low barrier can really be done with all this confidence interval stuff. Well, the bottom line is if you've got a lot of subjects and you have what is called an underlying continuous curve, an underlying philosophical or psychological concept underneath that, you can get away with it. Also, it helps to be retired. You can get away with a lot. All right, now, suppose, however, that we add another group to that. Guess who? Here they are. This, by the way, is the stuff here. Both students and faculty together see instructors at a high barrier. The faculty see students as far less a barrier than the students see themselves. And here it is now with the millennial instructor. And notice the millennial instructor right now starts right out being right along with the students, claiming the faculty are, in fact, the highest barrier. Little work, extra connection to the course. No, they're way over here. They actually were almost to the place where they might see that the connection to the course and the extra work that it takes is worth it. Isn't that cool? Isn't that neat? That's kind of nice for us. Wouldn't that be great to have a group of people that really felt that the extra work and the connection to the course would be worth it? I think that'd be just really cool. Takes too much time. They believe more that it takes more time than the students do, but far less concerned about it than the faculty. Over here, they're right in between. Down here, where it's too complicated, nope, they're way over here. And look, they almost blow out the end of the scale on, I don't have the skills. They really believe they've got the skills. Implementation, connection, okay. Time's a question, student use, and it's really pretty clear. It's not complicated for them, and they do feel that they've got that tech support, and they sure feel they've got the skills. Kind of a neat idea, isn't it? We're beginning to see an interesting pattern emerge here. So, characteristics, expertise, but take a look in three areas. They have certain preferences on how to learn. They have certain barriers to using technology and teaching and learning that do not reflect the same as the others. So we think that they might, in fact, be a different group. So how do we work with and guide such folk? Well, we get out of their way. Often we've been doing that, haven't we? The minute you spot them and you realize that they have the expertise and they can do it, you not only get out of the way, sometimes you really help support them and meet their special needs. You try to recognize and reward, but finally you just decide to retire. Okay, future investigation. Here's our problem, gang. We did not design the survey to take a look at this group of people, so our questions are not really, quote, right for that kind of thing. Should we ask directly, and how can we ask directly? Should we ask questions on multitasking? I'm not so sure if you do that, you'd find a great deal, because we know that there's an awful lot of professors out there that multitask almost as much as the students do. Of course, for us, it's called email. You know, that's what you're constantly doing. You got the email open and you're constantly doing it. Why? Not because you're a true believer in it, but because if you don't, it's going to bury you. You know what I'm talking about? What kinds of themes should we ask and what kinds of questions? In other words, what I'd like to do if we have an opportunity is open this up now and have you all raise questions, raise concerns, take a look at the methodology, tackle us on our question. Maybe we've tagged these people as even the wrong kind of people. Maybe they are not millennials. Maybe we have to look in a different direction. But, maybe we have identified a unique group here that truly could be that millennial faculty. So, multitasking, ease with technology, fits all of lifestyle, all connected. Those are all the characteristics we've looked at for the millennial student, particularly the lifestyle, always connected, ease with technology and multitasking. Could it be that we should ask those same kind of questions of our faculty to see what group of those fall into that and see if they are the same group? So at that point, I'm just going to stop right now and open it up for questions and comments from you folks. After all, that's what this should be about, getting your ideas. Right here. We're really not looking at motivation. We're not saying, you know, are you doing it because you firmly believe in it? Are you doing it because you're getting a reward for it or see getting a reward for it? I believe you had a question. You know, we're struggling with the two. Do we really have a millennial group or do we just have early adopters? You know, are they really early adopters or is this a millennial group? Because when you take a look at the millennial student, you would not always say that the millennial student reflects early adopters. They may represent a certain culture, but not necessarily early adopters, and we've got to get at that. You know, that's a really crucial question that you're raising. Go ahead. Shelley, I think you've really hit something that's really, really fascinating, and in fact, what you've started to define was the shift in our chemistry department as they began to shift away from not only being the top-notch, of course, every institution says it, the top-notch researchers in chemistry in the country, if not the world, but they began to realize that that did not necessarily transfer into top-notch teaching, and now it is appropriate. And in fact, one of the faculty members about 4 years ago got tenured based upon their teaching and teaching research. Notice teaching and teaching research. You still can't get tenured at Michigan without research. It had to be top-notch quality research, but it was research on the teaching of chemistry. Really fascinating, and that, I think, is a crucial point. Peter.
From your survey, do you know whether millennials are more likely to use technology in their research and their teaching than faculty members?
I think what we could say is that the millennials were more likely to use the technology in their teaching. And we couldn't determine whether they would use the technology more in their research. We could not determine that from. We had one of those great huge matrix questions that asked the question, you know, how often do you use X, Y, and Z? And it went down 23 lines, you know, all the way into research and stuff like that. So we can start to tell not only what proportion of the faculty, students, or millennials uses, for example, SPSS, but we can tell you how often they use it. And that's fascinating because you get a very low proportion of faculty, students, and millennials using it. But those that use it, you see that curve shift way over. The curve just slides way over. They use it a lot. So we can start to get at that, but we have not yet gotten. And that's how we get at that question that you're asking. Yes.
You could have someone who thinks that they're great at it, but in reality uses it no more than someone who thinks they're poor at it.
Yeah. One of our biggest shifts on our surveys, which happened about 8 years ago, was we stopped asking, do you use? And started asking, how often do you use, from the standpoint of daily, all the way up to once a term or once. You know, that's the kind of spread we got. That's certainly not a continuing underlying distribution, but you can apply a little logarithmic this and that to it and do a lot of cool stuff. But we asked it just because of that. Because if you ask, do you use, you really can't get at anything like that. You've got to ask, how much do you use? Scott. We provide for the particular schools and colleges, and even departments in the larger schools, we will provide a complete breakdown like this for them, as long as you can't look at the data and identify any person. Because, you know, sometimes it gets so small you can start to do that. But we actually do that. Oh, I wish you hadn't asked that question. The reason I wish you hadn't asked that question is that we send it out in kind of a broad swipe, and our biggest complaint came back from the staff who felt that they were not included in the survey per se because they were not considered librarians, which we had asked for. They were not considered technical support staff, clinical faculty, all those kinds of things. Now, we thought they would come in under technical support staff, but when we went back to our implementation of PeopleSoft, yes, you all noticed how I said that, we found out that that did not identify some of the people that we thought it should have. So we really erred in that. And the next one we do, we've got to go back and grab that. You know, we really heard about it. And that's our constituency. That's, you know, those represent the people I used to work with. Chuck, I love profile analysis, mainly because it gives you a visual feel that you can almost pulls you back rather than have a table of figures. You'd never be able to see that. And that's why I try to do a lot with the kind of graphical analysis. That's kind of a sub-research field of mine. You should see some of my graphs. They are just gorgeous. Well, hey, gang, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for listening to this EDUCAUSE podcast. You can listen to this and other podcasts or join our ever-growing community of bloggers at connect.educause.edu. Connect, learn, network, and grow at EDUCAUSE.